Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Isaiah chapter 14, which I will call the Restoration of Jacob. We start now in Isaiah 14, verses 1 through 2. Isaiah begins, "The Lord will have compassion on Jacob. Once again, he will choose Israel and will settle them in their own land. Aliens will join them and unite with the house of Jacob. Nations will take them and bring them to their own place. And the house of Israel will possess the nations as men servants and maidservants in the Lord's land. They will make captives of their captors and rule over their oppressors." Well, our first task is to see whom Isaiah is talking about in verse 1 when he says, again, God will choose Israel. What does Israel refer to? Well, there are two basic options. The first option is that Israel is referring to Judah returning after Babylon. And the other option is that it is referring to the whole nation of Israel, north and south, the whole 12 tribes, not just the two tribes of Judah returning from Babylon. The majority opinion seems to say this is referring to Judah, the southern two tribes, Judah and Benjamin, returning after Babylon. Well, if that is so, we have to explain why is Judah called Israel here. Well, sometimes Judah is called Israel. Sometimes Israel, of course, refers to the northern kingdom of Israel, but sometimes Israel refers to the southern two tribes. Sometimes Israel refers to the whole nation, north and south. Well, let's look at some examples where Judah is called Israel. The southern two tribes of Judah are called Israel. Ezekiel 13, verses 16, first part of the verse. "Those prophets of Israel who prophesied to Jerusalem and saw a vision of peace for her." Well, a prophet that's prophesying to Jerusalem is going to be a prophet of Judah, and using Hebrew parallelism here, the prophets of Israel are the prophets of Judah prophesying to Jerusalem. Malachi 1:1 and Malachi 2:11. "An oracle, the word of the Lord to Israel through Malachi." And then you drop down to chapter 2, verse 11 in Malachi. "Judah has acted treacherously, and a detestable thing has been done in Israel and in Jerusalem." Jerusalem is in Judah, and yet Israel is referred to here. Continuing in verse 11, "For Judah has profaned the Lord's sanctuary." Now, buttressing this view that the term Israel is referring to Judah in verse 1 of Isaiah 14, we can read some commentators' opinions. Here's Joseph Benson, quote, "He," that's Isaiah, "is continuing his discourse concerning Babylon and assigning the reason not only of its fall, but of the speedy approach of that fall, as predicted in the last clause of the preceding chapter." Now, if you go to the last clause of the preceding chapter, we read this, "Babylon's time is almost up. Her days are almost over." Well, if you're talking about Babylon, you're talking about the southern two tribes of Judah, because those were the tribes that were carried in exile to Babylon. Here's what Albert Barnes has to say on this verse. "He," that's God, "will pity the captive Jews in Babylon." Barnes also says the names Jacob and Israel here simply denote the Jews. It's not talking about the whole nation of Israel. It's just talking about the Jews. And more particularly, of course, it means the Jews that are coming back from Babylon. Matthew Poole says that Israel should be delivered from the Babylonish captivity. Of course, well, that would be Judah, who's delivered from the Babylonish captivity. So we've got other scriptures. We've got commentators equating the term Israel with Judah. Also, the context favors this. In our chapter, Isaiah 14, we drop down to verse 4 and read this. "You will sing this song of contempt about the king of Babylon and say how the oppressor has quieted down and how the raging has become quiet." The song of contempt about the king of Babylon. So this is all talking about the Babylonian captivity and the return therefrom. Or at least that's the majority opinion. Here's Adam Clark with the minority opinion. He says that the term Israel refers to more than just the two southern tribes. He says, Adam Clark does, that the name of Jacob and of Israel are used apparently with design in this place, each of which name includes the 12 tribes. In other words, Jacob is 12 tribes and Israel is 12 tribes. Clark says that other circumstances mentioned in this and the next verse do not have anything to do with the return from Babylon. I don't know what circumstances he's talking about. I haven't found any. He doesn't mention any. So we're not going to go with Mr. Clark on this option. We're going to say that this chapter, or at least the overwhelming majority of it, before we get to a prophecy against the Philistines, this prophecy is talking about, in chapter 14, the return of the Jews from Babylon, the southern two tribes returning from Babylon. Now in verse 1, the last part of the verse, Isaiah says that aliens will join them, will rejoin those who are returning from Babylon. They've already been settled in their own land at the first part of verse 1, and then aliens will join them, will join the returning Jews and reunite with the house of Jacob. Again, the house of Jacob means Israel in general, the southern two tribes. Jacob is just another word for Israel. Now, who are these aliens who are going to unite with Israel? Here's option number 1, proselytes to Judaism. Option number 2 is converts to Christ in New Testament times. That's from John Gill. He fulfills everything in the New Testament and skips the Old Testament, so we're not going to listen to Gill on this point. So how are these aliens proselytes to Judaism that are returning with the Jews who are being settled in their own land? How are these proselytes united with the house of Jacob? Well, Barnes says, if you want proof, go to Esther 8:17. In every province and in every city, wherever the king's command and his law reached, this is King Xerxes of the Persian Empire, joy and rejoicing took place among the Jews. There was a celebration and a holiday, and many of the ethnic groups of the land professed themselves to be Jews. Many of the ethnic groups of the lands, ethnic groups is nations, many nations of the land professed themselves to be Jews. Now, that refers to the time of Persia, which is after the Babylonian exile. Esther was written in the time of Xerxes, Ahasuerus, who reigned from 486 to 465, so we're a little bit later. But Isaiah could have been prophesying about aliens in the time even of Xerxes uniting with the house of Jacob. However, if you take aliens as those who settled with the returnees from Babylon to Israel, well then Esther 8:17 doesn't fit, because those returnees came back in 539 and Esther's in the next century. But if you say God will settle them in their own land, full stop, and then later on, aliens will join them and unite with the house of Jacob, and you could read it that way, then the proselytes at the time of Esther would fulfill Isaiah just fine. However, despite the fact that there is no direct evidence that Jewish proselytes were in Babylon, there's other evidence that says that there were Jewish proselytes in Babylon, and I bet you there were. Tacitus, for example, the famous Roman historian, attest to proselytes being everywhere, not just in Babylon. Tacitus was born in 56 BC and died around 120 AD. Tacitus, speaking of his time, again, this is about 500 years after the Babylonian captivity, says that every abandoned man despising the religion of his country bears tribute and revenue to Jerusalem, whence it happens that the number of the Jews is greatly increased. Barnes says, after quoting Tacitus, that the Jews, therefore, who were in Babylon, should induce many of the Chaldeans, the Babylonians, during their long captivity to become proselytes is in accordance with all their history. In other words, the Jews had proselytes everywhere. I think the great German church historian Trotsky, I can't remember how to pronounce his name, he said there were about 10% Jews in every Roman city in Asia Minor during the time of Christ. So there were proselytes everywhere. So I'm going to assume that these aliens, these proselytes, will come with the Jews back to Israel, as well as native Jews. Verse 2, nations will take them and bring them to their own place. What does that mean, nations? That means that other people, other ethnic groups beside Jews, Gentiles, in other words, the people among whom the Jews dwelt in Babylon, felt a special kindness for the Jews in Babylon, especially if they were proselytes. And so these people, proselytes as well as other friendly Gentiles, would attend the Jews in their journey home back to Israel. These friendly Gentiles and proselytes would supply the Jews with all necessaries for their provision and carriage back to Israel. Now, Albert Barnes says that this is doubtless a reference to the help that Cyrus would give them. We read in Ezra 1:4 from Cyrus's famous decree, which let the Jews go back about 538 B.C., let every survivor, wherever he lives, be assisted by the men of that region with silver, gold, goods, and livestock, along with a freewill offering for the house of God in Jerusalem. And then, two verses later, Ezra reports, all their neighbors supported them with silver articles, gold, goods, livestock, and valuables, in addition to all that was given as a free will offering. So, Isaiah's prophecy has been fulfilled perfectly. Now, at the end of verse 2, Isaiah says the house of Israel, that's still referring to the Babylonian returnees, they will possess the nations as men servants and maid servants. Well, what does that mean? Here's some options. Well, here's option number 1. They will possess the nations because they have made Babylonian proselytes. This is the option preferred by Barnes. Benson says it might be. Here's what John Gill says. Many of the Chaldeans coming along with the Jews and having embraced their religion chose rather to be servants and handmaids to them than to return to their own land, and who are a kind of inheritance or possession to the Jews. So the Jews possess the nations by actually owning them as slaves or as perhaps some other kind of servant. Benson says they were actual slaves. They could have been proselytes who were not slaves. But at any rate, then, the Jews would said to be captors of their Babylonian captives. Now, another option is that these Babylonian captives are Gentile proselytes converted to Jews. Now, another option is that these captives are Gentile proselytes converted to Judaism outside of Babylon. Our verse doesn't say they're necessarily in Babylon. So that's another option. Jameson Fawcett Brown gives us a fourth option. He says that the captives of the Jews were those won to Israel's God through moral force. That would include Old Testament people who were taught to worship Yahweh, or it could be New Testament people who were won to Yahweh. Here's what Benson says. Without question, these words have a further meaning in them and point at those times under the gospel when the apostles and other ministers of Christ, who were of the Jewish nation, should conquer a great part of the Gentile world and subject them to the worship of the true God, obedience to the Jewish Messiah, and the laws of Christianity. So either the Jews physically and literally took possession of the Babylonians by making them proselytes or slaves, or maybe the Jews took possession of other nations, of other Gentiles, by winning them over to Yahweh. And I think it's a stretch to say that this extends into the New Testament time when Christians converted Gentiles. But at any rate, the house of Israel in some way will possess the nations. They will make captives of their captors and rule over their oppressors. They're not going to be slaves anymore. We go now to verses 3 through 8 in Isaiah 14. On the day the Lord gives you relief from suffering and turmoil and cruel bondage, you will take up this taunt against the king of Babylon. How the oppressor has come to an end. How his fury has ended. The Lord has broken the rod of the wicked, the scepter of the rulers, which in anger struck down peoples with unceasing blows, and in fury subdued nations with relentless aggression. All the lands are at rest and at peace. They break into singing. Even the pine trees and the cedars of Lebanon exult over you and say, now that you have been laid low, no woodsman comes to cut us down. Now, Isaiah is addressing the king of Babylon, and the time frame he mentions in verse 3 is on the day the Lord gives you relief. We're going to assume this is the day that the Persians knocked off the Babylonians when King Belshazzar was having his famous feast when he saw the handwriting on the wall. Now, of course, Belshazzar was not really king. He was really regent Nabonidus, having fled the scene, but the king of Babylon is the ruler of Babylon. He's the perfect person to taunt because he was the last guy standing when the Persians came in. And so Isaiah says to the Jews, you can taunt this guy. How the oppressor has come to an end, how his fury has ended. The Lord has broken the rod of the wicked, the scepter of the rulers. The scepter, of course, is that rod which symbolizes regal authority. The scepter, the rod which in anger had struck down the peoples with unceasing blows, that would refer to the Babylonians. They had conquered everybody everywhere. The Syrians, the Assyrians, the Palestinians, the Moabites, the Edomites, the Israelites. And in verse 8, even the pine trees and the cedars of Lebanon exult over Babylon. Why? Well, because no more wood was needed for Babylonian ships and houses. Because the Babylonian Empire is defunct. It's gone. It's history. It's toast. No more houses, no more ships, no more wood is needed. So now no woodsman is going to come to the cedars of Lebanon and chop them down. We go down to Isaiah 14, verses 9 through 11. Isaiah continues, The grave below is all astir to meet you at your coming, talking about the king of Babylon's coming to Hades. The grave rouses the spirits of the departed to greet you. All those who were leaders in the world, it makes them rise from their thrones. The grave makes the leaders rise from their thrones. All those who were kings over the nations, but now they're dead, of course. They will all respond. They will say to you, you also have become weak as we are. You have become like us. All your pomp has been brought down to the grave. Along with the noise of your harps, maggots are spread out beneath you and worms cover you. Now, Isaiah is here resorting to a little bit of sarcasm. Everybody's waiting to meet you, O Belshazzar, king of Babylon. Unfortunately, the place of meeting is Hades, the grave. It used to be that people would meet kings when they visited places with a big banquet, a big reception. Everybody would stand and be astir in order to meet the incoming king, but that was when the king is alive. But down here in Hades, it's a little bit different. So all these dead kings are going to greet Belshazzar as he comes into Hades. They get up from their thrones to give him respect. And they're going to first say, oh, you've become weak as we are. Weak, why? Because they're dead. Dead people are pretty weak. You've become like us. In other words, dead. We're dead. You're dead. All your pomp has been brought down to the grave, just like us, along with the noise of your harps. Oh, all that beautiful music you had in your palace. Well, that's over with. Maggots are spread out beneath you and worms cover you. Ooh, that's a reference to, of course, what happens to corpses. That's what would happen to any common corpse that's not wrapped in spices as a king's corpse normally would be, but sooner or later the maggots and the worms are going to get anybody's corpse. Now we go to Isaiah 14, verses 12 through 15. How you have fallen from heaven, O morning star, son of the dawn. Again, Isaiah is still talking to the king of Babylon. You have been cast down to the earth, you who once laid low the nations. You said in your heart, I will ascend to heaven. I will raise my throne above the stars of God. I will sit enthroned on the Mount of Assembly, on the utmost heights of the sacred mountain. I will ascend above the tops of the clouds. I will make myself like the Most High. But you are brought down to the grave, to the depths of the pit. Now here, Belshazzar, the Babylonian king, is called the Morning Star. Now, how many times have we heard it said that this is a reference to Satan? That's because the King James translation, which says in verse 12, How art thou fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning? Well, this is where people erroneously get the idea that Satan's name is Lucifer. Satan is never called Lucifer anywhere. This verse right here does not refer to Satan. In my humble opinion, I know there's lots of people who say it does, but the whole context is talking about the king of Babylon, not about the devil. John Gillen and Adam Clark say that this is not a reference to the fall of Satan, agreeing with me. What does this refer to, the morning star? Well, this is the morning star, Venus, the planet, which comes up early in the morning. If you look in the sky near the horizon before the sun has come up and killed all the stars, you see this bright light in the sky. That's Venus. And that bright light is a symbol of the royal glory and majesty of the king of Babylon. That star, that morning star, which is really a planet, Venus, it outshines all the other stars in the sky, just like the glory and majesty of the king of Babylon outshone all the rest of the kings of the earth. But you've fallen from heaven. You're not shining in the sky anymore, Belshazzar. You have been cast down to the earth, you who once laid low the nations. Now here are some of the nations that Babylon has conquered. Assyria, Syria, Israel, Moab, Edom. They were a big, powerful empire, the Neo-Babylonian Empire was. That empire ran from 605 under Nebuchadnezzar at the Battle of Carchemish when Assyria was finally beaten, right on down to 539 when the Persians beat Belshazzar, which is not a long time, but they managed to knock off a whole bunch of nations during their short period of existence. Verse 13, Isaiah says, you, Belshazzar, you said in your heart, I will ascend to heaven, I will raise my throne above the stars of God. Above the stars of God is referring to the stars in the sky. If you raise your throne above those stars, well, then you're in heaven, aren't you? I will ascend to heaven, I will raise my throne above the stars. Two different ways of saying the same thing. He's arrogant, thinks he's God. I will sit enthroned on the Mount of Assembly. Now, what is this Mount of Assembly? It's also called the Sacred Mountain. So what is this Mount of Assembly, a mountain where people assembled, and it's also called a Sacred Mountain in verse 13? Well, here are our two options. Option number one, this is referring to Mount Zion. Now, a lot of the old commentators said this. The Mount of Assembly, for example, Poole says this, and it's called the Mount of Assembly because Mount Zion is where the people assembled before God when they went to the temple, and the temple was on Mount Zion, Mount Moriah, which is part of Mount Zion. And another argument in favor of saying that this Mount of Assembly is Mount Zion is that the phrase utmost heights here in the NIV is translated as the recesses of the north or the sides of the north. Recesses of the north by the New American Standard Bible, sides of the north by the King James. And the idea is that the temple is on the north of Mount Zion, which it is. Mount Moriah is just a little bit north, maybe north and northwest of Mount Zion. So there's your arguments that this sacred mountain, this Mount of Assembly, is Mount Zion. But there's a little problem with that interpretation. Why would the king of Babylon give a rip about Mount Zion? As Adam Barnes points out, not in such language, but with the same idea, it doesn't make any sense that he would want to sit himself on Mount Zion. What is Mount Zion to him? He could care less. So here is option number two. This is from Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown from the Pulpit Commentary. This sacred mountain is some unnamed mountain to the north of Babylon. As Barnes says, quote, it is most probable that by the Mount of the Congregation, the Mount of Assembly, in the sides of the north, there is reference to a belief prevalent in Babylon that the gods had their residence on some mountain of the north, heading up towards Armenia, somewhere up in there. And I am convinced that that's exactly what Isaiah meant. And backing me up on that is Albert Barnes, Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, and the Pulpit Commentary, perhaps some others that I haven't located yet. Now in verse 14, the king of Babylon, Belshazzar, says, I will make myself like the Most High. Now that's just like Satan tried to do. He tried to make himself like the Most High God, Yahweh. In fact, that's probably where the notion that Lucifer, that's mentioned in verse 1, O Morning Star, which again is translated as Lucifer in the King James, this is probably where the notion that Lucifer is Satan come from, because this king here says, I want to make myself like the Most High, which is exactly what the devil did. But it's not referring to the devil. We go now to Isaiah 14, verses 16 through 23. Those who see you stare at you, they ponder your fate. Is this the man who shook the earth and made kingdoms tremble? The man who made the world a desert, who overthrew its cities and would not let his captives go home? All the kings of the nations lie in state, each in his own tomb. But you are cast out of your tomb like a rejected branch. You are covered with the slain, with those pierced by the sword, those who descend to the stones of the pit. Like a corpse trampled underfoot, you will not join them in burial, for you have destroyed your land and killed your people. The offspring of the wicked will never be mentioned again. Prepare a place to slaughter his sons for the sins of their forefathers. They are not to rise to inherit the land and cover the earth with their cities. I will rise up against them, declares the Lord Almighty. I will cut off from Babylon her name and survivors, her offspring and descendants, declares the Lord. I will turn her into a place for owls and into swampland. I will sweep her with the broom of destruction, declares the Lord Almighty. Now in verse 16, Isaiah, those who see you stare at you in wonder and amazement as they ponder the king's fate. Now I've been saying the king was Belshazzar, but I think that King of Babylon is basically just a general representation of the Empire of Babylon, not necessarily the last king. In verse 16, when Isaiah says, those who see you, he's referring to those in Hades who are staring at the new arrival, the king of Babylon. They want to see if this nasty-looking man that's arriving was really a king, this man who shook the earth, who made the world a desert, who overthrew its cities and would not let his captives go home. He's probably referring to the Jews taken in 586 B.C. I say he, I mean Isaiah, quoting the dead spirits in Hades. Verse 18, all the kings of the nations lie in state. That means they're dead, each in his own tomb. But you are cast out of your tomb like a rejected branch. In other words, at least the other kings got a decent burial. But you didn't. You are cast out of your tomb. And of course, that was considered a horrible disgrace. I mean, look at the Egyptians. They spent scadzillions of the equivalent of American dollars to build these huge pyramids for their tombs. But this pathetic Babylonian king is going to be thrown out of his tomb. Jargil says that probably actually happened with Belshazzar. I don't know how he knows that. Maybe he's speculating. Cast out of his tomb like a rejected branch. This is a reference to a tree upon which a criminal has been hanged, which is very unclean, of course, in Jewish eyes. A rejected branch. A branch upon which a corpse was hung. Nasty. Throw it out. Just like this corpse was thrown out of its tomb. You are covered with a slain, covered with dead people, your own dead people. And, of course, that makes you even more unclean, according to Jews. Because, of course, a Jew could not touch a dead person, but this king of Babylon is covered with dead people. Covered with a slain, covered with those pierced by the sword, covered by those who descend to the stones of the pit, in other words, to the grave. Like a corpse trampled underfoot, you will not join them in burial. In other words, you're not going to get a decent burial. Why? Because you've destroyed your land, not only everybody else, but also Babylon. Now Babylon is wiped out by the Persians. You've killed your own people. The offspring of the wicked will never be mentioned again. Of course, the particular wicked that this chorus of dead kings is referring to is Belshazzar's offspring, the king of Babylon's offspring. Verse 21, prepare a place to slaughter his sons for the sins of their forefathers. Not only is Belshazzar going down, but also his sons. And of course, that prepare is sort of spoken off into the air, but it's referring to a reference of direct address to the Persians and the Medes. So in verse 21, Isaiah is saying, or these welcoming dead kings are saying, Medes, Persians, prepare a place to slaughter his sons. Prepare a place to wipe out the Babylonians, which happened, of course, in 539 B.C. They are not to rise to inherit the land and cover the earth with their cities. That's because the Persians took them over. I will rise up against them, declares the Lord Almighty. I will cut off from Babylon her name and survivors. Now, the city of Babylon is not being referred to here. This is the Empire of Babylon. The city of Babylon still has a name. In fact, it's still today called Babylon. It's a deserted archaeological site that Saddam Hussein tried to make into a tourist attraction and failed miserably to do so. But the Babylonian Empire is gone. It's never come back. The survivors of the Persian attack, gone. Her offspring and descendants, nowhere to be seen. They're gone. So Isaiah, remember, this prophecy is given just a little under 200 years earlier before the destruction of Babylon. This is a prophecy Isaiah has given, and he was exactly right. Verse 23, I will turn her into a place for owls and into swampland. Isaiah continues, I will sweep her with the broom of destruction, declares the Lord Almighty. It's actually Isaiah speaking God's words. A place for owls, the translation of that particular type of bird is debated, but whatever kind of bird it is, it shows that men were no longer going to live there. All you hear is, whoo, it's deserted. It's swampland. Actually, Babylon isn't situated in marshy ground by the river Euphrates, as John Gill says. John Gill says, when that river, the Euphrates, was turned by Cyrus, remember Cyrus the Persian, or his people, when they diverted the flow of the Euphrates River, it dropped the water below the portcullis that was guarding the entrance to the city. The city was astraddle the Euphrates River, so the Persians were able to walk under the gate and walk right on into the river. When that river was turned by Cyrus and afterwards its banks neglected in course of time, the water overflowed the place where the city was and all about it, and so easily came to be what is here predicted it should. In other words, it became a swamp. We go now to Isaiah 14, verses 24 through 27. Isaiah continues, the Lord Almighty has sworn. Now, this quotation here is from God. Surely, as I have planned, so it will be, and as I have purposed, so it will stand. I will crush the Assyrian in my land, on my mountains I will trample him down. His yoke will be taken from my people, and his burden removed from their shoulders. This is the plan determined for the whole world. This is the hand stretched out over all nations. For the Lord Almighty has purposed, and who can thwart him? His hand is stretched out, and who can turn it back? Now verses 24 through 27 are a denunciation of somebody. Verse 25, Isaiah says, or God says through Isaiah, I will crush the Assyrian in my land. Well, the problem is we've been talking in the first 23 verses about the Babylonians getting crushed, not the Assyrians. So who is being referred to here in verse 25? Two options. The king of Babylonia, option number one, or option number two, the Assyrians. Option number two really has 2 points. Let's call option number two Sennacherib, and option number three, Shalmaneser V, and Sargon II. Well, let's start with option number one. I will crush the Assyrian. Is that the king of Babylonia? Well, sometimes the king of Assyria is called the king of Babylonia. After all, the Babylonian king was living in the land of Assyria between the rivers, Mesopotamia. The problem with that, though, is that Isaiah says, I will crush the Assyrian in my land, that would be the land of Israel, on my mountains I will trample him down, in the land of Israel. Babylon was never trampled in the land of Israel. Now the Cambridge commentator says this, in spite of the absence of a title, these verses cannot, without violence, be explained as a continuation of the oracle on Babylon. And I think the Cambridge commentator is right, so now we're talking about Assyria. So we made a switch to Assyria, Isaiah has. Now, which Assyrian king is particularly being talked about here? Well, I mentioned Shalmaneser V and Sargon II, that was in 722 BC. You would have to assume that Isaiah wrote the prophecy before 722, but since nobody really knows when he wrote the prophecy, that's a possibility. Pulpit commentator says this is possibly an option, but most of the commentators say this is Sennacherib. I will crush the Assyrian in my land. This is when Sennacherib, 701 BC, when he came in from Assyria to attack the land of Israel, he wiped out a whole bunch of cities in Israel and ended up before the walls of Jerusalem. Famous story, which we'll get to shortly. Now, who are the commentators that agree that this Assyrian that's going to be crushed in the land of Israel was Sennacherib? Barnes, Benson, Ellicott, Cambridge, Poole, Pulpit. So we're going to go with that one. So I will crush Sennacherib in my land, God is saying. His yoke will be taken from my people. Yes, Sennacherib ran back. Remember, there was a big plague. Wiped out his army, and he left, his burden removed from their shoulders. Now, why is Assyria mentioned here after all the first 23 verses referring to Babylon? Well, Albert Barnes says that Isaiah has a design that embraces the destruction of both Assyria and Babylonia. One of my commentators says that the destruction of Assyria is mentioned for the comfort of God's people as a pledge and assurance of the latter deliverance, the first deliverance being Assyria, the second being Babylonia. So it's both Assyria and Babylon. Kyle and Delitzsch say this, at a time when the prophecy against Assyria had actually been fulfilled, the prophet attached it to the still unfulfilled prophecy against Babylon to give a pledge of the fulfillment of the latter. Well, Kyle and Delitzsch assumed that Isaiah was prophesying after 722 BC. Again, I don't know how they know that, but I quote them there to show that they believe that the two deliverances, Assyria and Babylon, are mentioned together in the same chapter, in the same prophecy, to give comfort to Israel, because they're going to be delivered from their two big calamities. Verse 26, Isaiah has finished quoting the Lord, and now he says, this is the plan determined for the whole world. The whole world? John Gill says that some have thought this refers to the whole world at the time of Christ's return. I don't think so. I think that the whole world means the whole Assyrian Empire, because the whole world at that time was run by the Assyrian Empire, the whole ancient Near East, and that's as far as people could see back then. When Isaiah considered his whole world, he would be considering the ancient Near East. So this plan, this wiping out of the Assyrians, the wiping out of Sennacherib, it was determined for the whole Assyrian Empire. This is the hand stretched out over all nations, this taking away of the burden from Israel. Verse 27, for the Lord Almighty has purposed, and who can thwart him? His hand is stretched out, and who can turn it back? God decided he wanted to deliver Israel. Assyria can just forget about it. It's going to happen. We go now to Isaiah 14, verses 28 through 32, and we will be finished with our discussion of Isaiah 14. Isaiah continues, this oracle came in the year King Ahaz. So this is another oracle here tacked on to the last five verses of Isaiah 14. This oracle came in the year King Ahaz. Now remember, Ahaz ruled from 732 to 716, so this is the year that Ahaz died. This oracle came in the year that Ahaz died. So this is 716 BC. Isaiah says, do not rejoice, all you Philistines, that the rod that struck you is broken. From the root of that snake will spring up a viper. Its fruit will be a darting, venomous serpent. The poorest of the poor will find pasture, and the needy will lie down in safety. But your root I will destroy by famine. It will slay your survivors. Wail, O gate! Howl, O city! Melt away, all you Philistines! A cloud of smoke comes from the north, and there is not a straggler in its ranks. What answer shall be given to the envoys of that nation? The Lord has established Zion, and in her his afflicted people will find refuge. Now in verse 28, when Isaiah says this oracle came in the year King Ahaz died, Isaiah is not referring to the prophecies against Babylon in the first part of the chapter. He's referring to a new oracle against the Philistines. As Barnes says, quote, "This is the caption or title to the following prophecy, which occupies the remainder of this chapter. This prophecy has no connection with the preceding and should have been separated from it in the division into chapters." Now in verse 29, we have a bunch of nouns being used as symbols, so we need to look at this. "Do not rejoice, all you Philistines." Before we do look at it, let's talk about the Philistines here. What's the purpose of the prophecy? Was it to call the Philistines to repentance? No, there's no evidence that the prophecy was ever given to the Philistines. The purpose was to comfort the Jews, to let them know that they did not need to fear the Philistines. They didn't need to fear that the Philistines might invade during the reign of Ahaz's successor, Hezekiah. Remember, this is all about Hezekiah versus Sennacherib. As in verse 25, "I will crush the Assyrian in my land, Sennacherib." And when that happens, you don't need to worry while that's going on that the Philistines are going to come down into Israel and wipe you out. Now, some people actually have the crazy idea that these Philistines here refer to current-day Palestinians. "Do not rejoice, all you Palestinians." These Palestinians are to be judged for the way they oppose Israel. This has nothing to do with modern-day Palestinians. They might be judged for opposing Israel, and they might be politically obnoxious, but this is not what this prophecy is referring to. Now, in verse 29, we have a rod, we have a snake, and we have a root of the snake, and we have a viper. So let's put this all together. The rod and the snake are the same thing. The rod and the snake struck the Philistines first, and then the snake is going to have a root. Imagine you will, a snake that's cut in half, and what's left of the snake, the root of the snake. Out of that snake springs up a viper. Of course, biologically, that's not going to happen, but poetically, this is what Isaiah is talking about. So again, the rod and the snake strike the Philistines in time one. In time two, the root of the snake produces a viper. So we've got a snake in time one, a viper in time two. The rod is in time one. So the rod and the snake strike the Philistines in time one, and then a viper springs up from the root of the snake, and that strikes the Philistines in time two. So let's look at three options as to who the rod, the snake, is that first strikes the Philistines. First option is Ahaz, who ruled from 732 to 716. Barnes and Benson say that this is the rod who smote the Philistines, and this is who is causing the rejoicing of the Philistines at his death, at Ahaz's death, because a new and young king would be placed on the throne and Ahaz is gone. And so then Ahaz is said to have struck the Philistines. He dies. The Philistines rejoice. Then a viper springs up in time two, and that would be Hezekiah. 2 Kings 18:8. Hezekiah defeated the Philistines as far as Gaza and its borders from watchtower to fortified city. So that idea here is that hey, Ahaz was bad, but Hezekiah's worse. The problem with this is that Ahaz did not smite the Philistines, but actually Ahaz was smitten by the Philistines. The Philistines invaded Ahaz's country and took many of his cities. We read that in 2 Chronicles 28:18. The Philistines also raided the cities of the Judean foothills in the Negev of Judah and captured Beth Shemeth, Ajalon, Geraroth, Soko and his villages, Timnah and its villages, Gimzo and its villages, and they lived there. Well, Barnes and Benson are not stupid. Why did they pick this choice that Ahaz is the rod that struck Philistines? Well, you could save their position by saying that the rod that struck the Philistines was not Ahaz in particular, but the house of Judah in general. As Benson says, because the rod of him that smote thee is broken, smote the Philistines, because Ahaz, the son of Uzziah, thy deadly enemy, is cut off, because he died, or because the power of the kings of Judah, not just Ahaz, but because the power of the kings of Judah is now much impaired. So the reference would be to the whole royal line of Judah, not just Ahaz. Well, I assume we'll have to go that way if we're going to hold to the option that this rod, this snake that bashed the Philistines in time one, is Ahaz. Now, I said the root is the same thing as the snake. That was to keep it simple. Actually, we can posit that the root of the snake being Ahaz, The root of that snake would be Ahaz himself as he dies, or the root of that snake could be Jesse, because Jesse is the root of the whole house of David, and Ahaz, of course, is in the house of David. Well, that's just to make it more complicated. Let's go to option number two as to who this rod, the snake that struck the Philistines in time one, is. Uzziah, according to Adam Clark. That's option number two. Uzziah reigned before Ahaz. Uzziah reigned from 767 to 740. Ahaz started his reign in 732. Now, Uzziah, unlike Ahab, had great success against the Philistines. He broke down the walls of their cities. 2 Chronicles 26, 6 through 7. Uzziah went out to wage war against the Philistines, and he tore down the wall of Gath, the wall of Jabneh, and the wall of Ashdod. Those are Philistine cities. Then he built cities in the vicinity of Ashdod and among the Philistines. God helped him against the Philistines, and so naturally the Philistines would rejoice when he died. So if Clark is right and Uzziah is the rod that struck the Philistines, Uzziah dies, the Philistines rejoice, who's the viper that comes from Uzziah's root? Well, that would be Hezekiah. Hezekiah, of course, came after Uzziah. Hezekiah reigned from 716 to 687. In 2 Kings 18:8, we read this. He, that's Hezekiah, defeated the Philistines as far as Gaza and its borders, from watchtower to fortified city. Gaza, of course, is at the southern end of the Philistine territory, right as you're heading down to Egypt. And so Uzziah would be the root. Uzziah would be the snake, and out of that root, a new viper comes up, and that would be Hezekiah. So the Philistines in time one would be whopped by Uzziah and then whopped even worse by Hezekiah at time two. Well, that's option number two as to who the rod is and who the snake is. Option number one, remember, was Ahaz. Ahaz's viper would be Hezekiah. Uzziah is option number two. He's the snake and the rod, and his viper would be Hezekiah also. Option number three, the Assyrians. This is Ellicott's option, and more particular, Tiglath-Pileser III. Now, I tend to favor this option. Tiglath-Pileser III ruled from 745 to 727. He ruled before and after King Ahaz of Judah. Ellicott says this, the Philistines had invaded the low country, the Shephelah, and the district known as the Negev, or south of Judah, in the reign of Ahaz. He had called in the help of Tiglath-Pileser, the Assyrian king, to assist him as against Rezin and Pekah, so probably he did the same thing against these new invaders, the Philistines. That's a supposition. He can't prove it. So we assume that the rod that struck the Philistines was Tiglath-Pileser III, even though the scripture doesn't say so. The next question is, when was that rod broken, causing the Philistines to rejoice? Well, Ellicott says it's when Tiglath-Pileser III died. Okay, so he dies. Well, then who's the viper that springs from the root of Tiglath-Pileser III? Well, three options. The first option is Sargon II. He invaded Ashdod in 710, according to Ellicott. And Ellicott's dates are old. 710 might not be accurate, but sometime in the early 8th century, Sargon II invaded Ashdod. And then Sennacherib, who ruled from 705 to 681, he attacked Ashkelon and Ekron. That was probably before 701 when he attacked Jerusalem and had his army wiped out by plague. And then, of course, Nebuchadnezzar, not of Assyria, but of Babylon, he came in and attacked all the areas around Jerusalem at roughly the time of the Babylonian destruction of Israel in 586. And so the Philistines had a lot more to worry about than Tiglath-Pileser III. So to summarize all this, verse 29, do not rejoice, all you Philistines, that the rod that struck you is broken. That rod could either be Ahaz and Uzziah, and the viper that springs up after that snake is wiped out would be Hezekiah. Or the rod that struck the Philistines is Tiglath-Pileser III of Assyria, and the viper that springs up to whop the Philistines again could be all of these three together. Sargon II, Sennacherib, or the Babylonian king Nebuchadnezzar. We move now to verse 30. Isaiah says, the poorest of the poor will find pasture, and the needy will lie down in safety. In other words, all of you Philistines who are attacking Israel in the time of King Ahaz, after Ahaz dies in 716, and this prophecy against the Philistines takes place, and the Philistines get struck, then the poor in Ahaz's time, in Hezekiah's time, are going to lie down in safety. But your root, in other words, the tree of the Philistines, I will destroy by famine. It will slay your survivors. I've already talked about all the times the Philistines got whopped. Verse 31, Wail, O gate. Why the gate? Because that's where all the judicial and political leaders congregated, and so that means the leadership of the Philistines was wiped out. Howl, O city. In other words, every Philistine city. Melt away, all you Philistines. A cloud of smoke comes from the north. Now, that cloud of smoke coming from the north could be Nebuchadnezzar's army coming right around the time of 586 B.C. It could be Hezekiah's army, which lay to the north of Philistia. Some have even speculated it's a Roman army taking Jewish country where the Philistines used to be. I don't think so. I tend to think it's Hezekiah coming to whip up on the Philistines. There's not a straggler in its ranks. In other words, the army is in martial array, not stumbling around as the army goes to attack Philistia. Verse 32, what answer shall be given to the envoys of that nation? Well, who were these envoys to whom the answer was given? Here's four options. Option number one, other nations are going to Jerusalem. This is Colin Delitzsch's option, Poole's option. This is assuming that Hezekiah is the viper that arises next to strike the Philistines, which seems to be the majority view. So these other nations are sending envoys to go to Jerusalem to ask about Hezekiah's victory over the Philistines, or maybe to congratulate Hezekiah, or maybe to form an alliance with the Jews. That's Colin Delitzsch and Poole. That makes a lot of sense. Some people say the envoys are sent from the Philistines to Isaiah. And the Philistines go to Isaiah, and they say, what's going on? And Isaiah answers, the Lord has established Zion, and in her his afflicted people will find refuge. In other words, you ain't going to win, Philistines. You've lost. Option number three, the envoys could be coming from the Philistines to Jerusalem. That's the pulpit commentary. Same idea. They ask, what's going on? Or, we surrender. Colin Delitzsch says it's individuals who escaped from the Assyrian army. And these individuals asked Hezekiah, what's going on? What's going to happen? The answer being, the Lord has established Zion, and in her his afflicted people will find refuge. In other words, Jerusalem's not going down to Sennacherib. Ladies and gentlemen, we have now finished Isaiah 14, and we're prepared now to go to Isaiah 15, which I will entitle An Oracle Concerning Moab. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.